It's the wired.co.uk podcast, episode 91 for Friday the 31st of August 2012. On the show this week, we pay homage to the first man to walk on the moon and find out why it's bad news bears for both Iranian World of Warcraft players and Arctic ice. Also, we'll hear all of the latest news from consumer tech extravaganza IFA and answer the question, what is the link between 17th century witchcraft and the 2011 London riots? All that and more coming up. Hello, I'm Olivia Solon and I'm the Associate Editor of Wired.co.uk. And joining me in this trinket cupboard of joy is reporter Liat Clark.
Hello all.
And junior staff writer Ian Steadman.
Afternoon.
Now, this is weird, right?
It's very weird.
Very different.
No Nate.
He's currently in Berlin at IFA. And no Duncan.
No Duncan.
Left us.
He has departed Wired.co.uk.
Let us never speak of him again.
No, let's not. Now, last week, we kind of pulled back the curtain on where we record our podcast. We showed you in all our glory in a video the trinket cupboard where we record. So hopefully those of you listening this week can imagine us surrounded by soft furnishings and
scented candles
and weird brightly coloured rope.
Oh, yes. Where's that?
She's a magpie.
It's right here. There. Check that out. I mean, why you need fuchsia-coloured Hessian rope? I don't know, but
you don't have any?
It's there. No, I don't. Now, we're going to start off with some sad news that Neil Armstrong, the very first man to set foot on the moon, has died at the grand old age of 82. Very sad. He died after complications during heart surgery. Now, Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin were both walked on the moon in 1969 as part of the Apollo 11 mission. And it was actually Neil who said that iconic line, "That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind." But he fluffed the line a bit, didn't he?
He did. He meant to say A-man, not man, A-man, just because man and mankind otherwise mean the same thing.
Yeah, but I think that's a bit weird, because I think it sounds better as is, but...
It does. I think they have the same number of syllables if you do it without the A, but I'm not sure. I'd have to count.
So it's more poetic.
Yeah.
Excellent. There was actually a third member, Michael Collins, but he got stuck orbiting in the command module overhead. And as such, no one's really heard of him.
I keep hearing about him all the time, but then forgetting about him again, which is maybe even worse.
Yeah, how about you, Liat?
Yeah, you know, I read the name from time to time, but then it flies through.
It passes.
I keep getting confused with the guy in U2 who has a similar name.
Yeah, now this is something that Neil Armstrong was really, really uncomfortable with. He was an engineer by trade, and he felt that he didn't deserve all of the attention because it was such a huge collaborative endeavour. And interestingly, many of the articles and the obituaries about him talk about how much he didn't seek fame, unlike other astronauts. And most of them, if they're not directly referencing him, are referring to Buzz Aldrin, who seems to absolutely love fame. Liat, you actually met him recently, didn't you?
I did, yes. He's a real charmer of a man, and I think rightly so. He does like the fame games. He has people literally flock around him and attempt to stroke his shoulders as he walks past.
So you saw this happen? Someone goes up to him and tries to touch him so they can say, "I've touched someone who has touched the moon."
As he walked down the corridor, there was just a stream of arms just extended and kind of just patted
like
on the shoulder lightly.
A kind of the Pope or something.
Yeah, well, like they were touching the moon.
It's the closest any of us will get to actually being on the moon, I guess. So.
Absolutely. Somewhat poignantly, it's pretty much precisely 50 years, give or take a week, since JFK gave his famous Man on the Moon speech, which was in 1962, and he predicted that we'd put a man on the moon within a decade. And by 1969, we had, well, the US had achieved that. So unfortunately, Neil Armstrong wasn't around to experience the discovery of two planets orbiting two stars. Liat, tell us about this.
Yes, Olivia, astronomers have proved there's still always something to get excited about when it comes to space, with the announcement they've spotted two planets orbiting a binary star system. Now, we've known about circumbinary planets for a while, which is one planet orbiting two stars, but this is the first time they've ever spotted multiple planets in the system. So this was spotted out in the Cygnus constellation. The find has astrophysicists wondering if they should really go back to the drawing board, because this is such an unlikely scenario that two planets would survive the gravitational pull of two suns. So a few professors have come forward and said it's so unlikely, when applying what we already know about how planets form, that it's going to teach us in the long run a lot more about planet formation.
So why is it so unlikely that two planets could orbit two stars?
Well, they have to survive the gravitational pull of two suns, and they have to circumnavigate what is essentially a moving target, which is the second sun. And until now, it was assumed that If there were two planets in a binary star system, they would be pushed out of the orbit or collide into one another.
And so what's different about these? Like, how are they surviving?
Well, it's been suggested that it's because of they have such a small mass. Despite being larger than the Earth, they are relatively small in relation to the stars they're orbiting. Yeah, and their orbits, I think the reason they spotted the planets in the first place was because their orbits were so distinctly different, 50 days and 303 days, which is apparently a sign of a circumbinary planetary system.
Okay. Yeah. Now, this was spotted by the Kepler telescope. What are the next plans given this discovery?
Well, I think they're quite excited that perhaps they could seek out a third planet orbiting a binary star system.
That's just greedy, surely.
One professor came up
orbiting three suns.
Whoa. But one professor came forward saying, we're going to try and hunt three planets out, and if we find that, the sky is the limit.
Oh, very cheesy and trite. Oh, but thank you to that professor. So back to Earth now. Ian, when I was about 12 and I'd be studying for exams, I'd obviously do cramming in the daytime. But then when I went to bed, I would put the notes under my pillow and hope that somehow they would be absorbed into my mind at night. Now, there's a new study that's saying that this sort of thing might be possible.
No. Well, kind of, maybe, sort of. Possibly. It's a study from the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel. Some neuroscientists have found out that you can learn when you're asleep. You don't do anything, you learn new stuff. But it's not exactly the same as cramming for an exam. They basically took some conditioning, kind of Pavlovian condition that you do with dogs, that they've done with humans before, where they've conditioned humans to associate certain smells with certain sounds.
Okay.
So you have, the smell of rotting fish, and you play a sound.
Yeah.
And then you waft that over the subject, and then you get a different smell and waft it over the same subject with a different sound. And over time, when that person hears the sound, they think of the smell.
Okay.
And they did this with people who were sleeping with 55 different sounds and smells, and it turned out that they remembered them when they woke up, even though they didn't know that they'd learned them.
See, that's creepy. So they didn't tell the people that this is what they were going to do. They just said, go to sleep,
yep,
and it'll all be fine in the morning.
We're just going to do some stuff to you while you're sleeping.
Yeah.
Scientists have amazing jobs.
I wonder how they persuaded participants for that.
Money?
Yeah, that's a good point.
But it's fascinating, because up until this point, we've always known that sleep and memories and knowledge are all interlinked, and that there have been several studies that suggest that when we are sleeping and when we're dreaming, what the brain is doing is kind of taking everything it's learned during the day and sort of filing it away and putting it into the long-term memory, so that when you wake up you know it better. And we have demonstrated before that that certain memories can be improved by sleeping. So you go to sleep with an incomplete memory, you wake up and you can remember something better.
Okay.
But the reason this is so exciting is that it's completely new knowledge. These people were being played the sounds after waking up, and sort of involuntary, kind of going sniffing. And
oh, that's awful. Can you just imagine, like, I don't know what the sounds were, but imagine if they were kind of sounds you might hear on your commute, for example. And, you know, the smells are bad enough as it is. So imagine you hear a specific, I don't know,
tone.
Ding of a bus, and suddenly you smell rotten fish in addition to the BO that you've got of some, you know, guy's armpit in your face.
Or it could be used to positive effect. I mean, it could smell of chocolate and flowers.
That's so true, but rotting fish was a smell that you mentioned.
It was. Rotting fish, shampoo. They did a whole range of stuff. Rotting fish, shampoo, petrol, you name it, just to see what would happen, and it worked.
But it's obviously not the same, as you say, as learning, just putting your kind of history exam under your pillow and absorbing that information.
No, because it's a very different kind of knowledge to, say, knowing the date of some battle in history or knowing how to speak French. And more research has to be done on this, because they really don't know how this can be applied.
Okay.
They don't know exactly what phases of sleep it works best in. They think it might be REM, rapid eye movement sleep.
Yeah.
Which is when you're kind of moving between deep sleep and waking up again, and your eyes tend to flicker a bit.
Yeah.
And that's when you dream the heaviest. And they think that might be when this process works the best. But again, they need to look into it more.
Okay, well, that is extremely cool. But something that is not quite so cool is the Arctic ice cap, which is melting, sadly. So again, bad news bears for the ice cap. This is something we actually talked about at length last week in the podcast for Duncan's final podcast. This was a story very close to his meteorological heart. Mm. And last week it was predicted that the Arctic ice cap was likely to melt to its lowest ever recorded level. And this has now, in fact, happened. And it's continuing to melt. So on the 26th of August 2012, according to the National Snow and Ice Data Centre, the cap surface area fell to 4.1 million square kilometres. That sounds quite a lot, but this is actually 70,000 square kilometres below the levels in 2007, which was the previous lowest melt. Now, typically, the region reaches its seasonal low in mid to late September.
So there's still melting to go.
So there's still, a couple of weeks of melting to go. So environmentalists are understandably particularly worried about this. Shay Wolf from the Centre for Biological Diversity described this as a profound and profoundly depressing moment in the history of our planet. Now, there's some more depressing news, not quite as profoundly depressing, but slightly depressing if you are an Iranian World of Warcraft fan. Isn't that right, Liat?
Yes, indeed. There were a few tears shed last week across Iran when fans tried to log on to World of Warcraft last week and found that they could not. Now, after quite a stream of angry comments on the forum board, Blizzard Activision, which produces the game, finally came on and said the reason that it's being blocked is because of US trade restrictions and sanction laws dictating that US companies should not do business with certain nations such as Iran, Libya, Cuba and Syria.
But they've been taking money from Iranian customers up until this point. And they're now saying they're not going to offer them refunds.
Yeah, I believe that according to their terms and conditions and sanction laws, they have no reason to offer refunds. They will not be offering refunds. And yet they did happily take the money right up until they were blocked. And, there was no warning message going out, so fans were just buying away to their heart's content.
That's very unfair, isn't it?
Yeah, it's extremely unfair, especially considering this has been the case all along, that Blizzard should not have technically been doing business with Iran. It's strange anyway that they have suddenly decided to enforce the terms and conditions which have been in place for some time.
But there's some stories saying that Iran was maybe going to be considering banning World of Warcraft anyway, as it kind of clamps down increasingly on the web.
Yeah, the timing of the whole thing is a bit suspect, considering about a week before fans started reporting they could not log on, stories had surfaced that there was a conference held in Iran for the launch of the Islamic Revolution Game Designers Community, which is a state-funded community. At this conference, people were handed out leaflets which used World of Warcraft as an example of Western propaganda, poisoning the mind of Iran's youth with things like mythology, superstition, and slutty outfits for female avatars, which was a direct quote from one of the reasons put on the leaflet. So Blizzard did actually make a point of saying, we've heard about these rumours, but we can't comment on what another country may or may not be doing.
So it might have been a kind of preemptive strike in fear that it's going to be blocked anyway. We might as well just pull the business and stop serving that country altogether.
Exactly, yeah. Or you never know, Iran may be pulled the block already and Blizzard decided to put the comment out.
Yeah.
Everyone's a little bit sceptical as to the timing.
Well, very unlucky if you are an Iranian World of Warcraft fan. Now, we're about to take an ad break, but when we come back, we're going to find out what the connection is between witches who got tried in 1612 and the London riots.
Wired's second annual summit is coming. Following a sellout debut in 2011, Wired 2012 will feature an incredible lineup of speakers and thought-provoking talks over 2 days in London. The first names have already been announced, so find out more at wiredevent.co.uk.
Welcome back. So, Ian, witches.
Witches.
And riots.
They're everywhere. And riots are everywhere, apparently.
What's the link between them?
The link between them is an album by the Excentronic Research Council. They've created an album, a concept album, called the 1612 Overture, which is about the Pendle witchcraft trials, which, if you haven't heard of them before, Pendle is a town in Lancashire, sort of near Manchester. And in 1612... there were 12 people accused of witchcraft, of which 10 were eventually executed. They were hung or
hanged.
Hanged. They were hanged until they were dead. They were just normal people, 9 women, 1 man. One man. Well, in those days, it was actually quite an equal opportunities.
Was it?
Accusation.
Well, not that equal if it was 9 to 1, but.
It did tend to be old crones, to use the traditional expression.
Oh,
but,
lovely.
They tended to be sort of local. Weird people or poor people, uneducated, people who were easily accused of stuff they hadn't done, or people who were simply poor and were just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Okay, so just to rewind a little bit, the Excentronic Research Council isn't actually an organisation doing research,
is
it?
It's a kind of musical collection of people, artists and musicians, who've come together to create this album. And it's kind of a narrative piece that combines synths and Kraftwerkian techno, and Maxine Peake is the narrator. She's an actress from Shameless.
Okay, and we can actually hear some of that, the music from this album that they've made now.
Yeah, the album takes the form of a kind of narrative story, narrated by Maxine Peake, and it starts out as a road trip down the A666, which is known as the Devil's Highway in that part of the world.
See what they've done there.
Yeah, and apparently the witchcraft trials, even though they were 400 years ago, are still kind of seen as local legend. Local kids are told to look out for the witches and stuff like that. And the reason this links into the riots, and by the end of it, you kind of see as the show trials go on and everything like that, it links together with the riots of last year, in the sense that you still see people that not literally demonized anymore, but metaphorically demonized, where people who were kind of rioting to steal bottles of water and bags of rice were put away for 6 months or a year or whatever.
I mean, it's not the most obvious link between these witches and rioters.
No, but it's a good excuse to sort of make a haunted, ghosty album, I think.
Yeah, it's a good creative mashup, I suppose.
It is. It's musically really interesting. And the narration by Maxine Peake is very, very good. She's a really, really good voice actress.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's an album, but then there's also kind of is an audiovisual.
Yeah,
album.
It is. There is a video that goes with it, which is actually on our site. If you search for the 1612 Overture, it should pop up.
Excellent. Now, from Lancashire to China, specifically Shenzhen, which is the area in China where many electronic goods manufacturers are located.
Workshop of the world.
The workshop of the world. That's lovely.
Workshop of the world.
Companies such as Apple, HP, Samsung and Nokia all have either components or whole products made over there. It's actually where the Foxconn's based, which is the mega manufacturer that makes stuff for all sorts of different companies, and has been under lots of scrutiny for the working conditions. But anyway, the news is that the area is going to increase the minimum wage for workers by 13.3% starting from 2011.
How big an increase is that?
It sounds like quite a big percentage, and it is, I guess, on the aggregate, but it actually, workers there make currently around £149 per month. So this is only going to go up by about £20 per month to £169, which is still obviously dirt cheap by Western labour standards.
But there's cost of living and stuff to be taken into account, so.
Absolutely. And, one of the big things that's come up surrounding this story is the fact that this is likely to have an impact on, well, it definitely will have an impact on tech companies' costs, which could, in fact, lead to price rises for computers, handsets and games consoles and various other things that are made over there.
Is that really fair, though? Because a lot of the margins on the stuff that's made over there is really big. Like, for instance, Apple currently can't spend its money fast enough. Literally, it's been giving its money back to its shareholders.
Yeah.
So you'd think that they could be able to just absorb a price
rise. I think they could
like
afford
this.
It. I think Apple could afford it.
Yeah.
But people.
The others,
like,
I guess, yeah.
The others, yeah, not all of them are in such a fortunate position. But this this rise in minimum wage has come after a string of protests from workers over the first half of this year, who obviously, you know, recognise the contribution they're making to these huge international companies and understandably want to reap some of those rewards. Now, some analysts are even predicting that the cost of manufacturing in China could go up by three times by 2020, could triple by 2020, let's say, instead of three times. But that's a massive amount.
Yeah.
And that really could have a big impact on the bottom line.
People could start moving away to countries like Vietnam or Malaysia.
Yeah, there's already some signs of moving away from Shenzhen, because obviously there's China's a huge country and there are many other areas which have cheaper labour costs. Still, it's done a kind of in a regional way, these decisions. But again, China's developed such an incredible infrastructure and such incredible skills that I think it'll be pretty difficult for us to cut our ties with it anytime soon. And 2020 is actually pretty soon.
Yes.
Now, a lot of the products on show at IFA will have been made in Shenzhen. And this IFA is where Nate currently is. It's a huge tech fest in Berlin. Imagine kind of being in a PC world, and then imagine that PC world was like the size of four football pitches. And you've got a sort of an idea of what it's like to be at IFA. It's these huge, huge halls with where all the tech companies like produce and show off their kind of latest products, and they kind of unleash all their new laptops and mobile phones. It's not quite the same scale as CES, which takes place at the beginning of the year in the States, but it gives you a good indication of what sorts of products will be on our shelves in time for Christmas. Now, Nate is obviously not presenting this podcast, because I am, but he's in Berlin, and I managed to catch up with him a little bit earlier to find out what tech treats he's been getting his hands on.
Nate, this is weird. I'm doing your job.
Yes, hello. You are, and I'm doing someone else's job in terms of being interviewed, which is quite fun. I'm sat in a hotel room drinking water out of a bottle that's got a giant plastic cap, and just been listening to a podcast about how the immune system can affect the brain in people with psychosis and personality disorders, some new research. So I'm having quite a fun time.
Excellent. Now, you're in Berlin for IFA. How is that?
It's good. It's kind of weird at the moment because the show doesn't officially open till tomorrow. So there's sort of the glossy presentation that you generally see at these sort of trade shows when they're on the TV. It's kind of they're all broken down right now. So the sort of stages being set up and, you know, various things left, right and centre being erected and floors being laid. So it's a bit mad, but it's quite good. It's sort of a bit of a frenzy over here.
So you've been seeing lots of different companies. What have been the main trends?
Well, fortunately, this year, it's not 3D. This is, generally speaking, over the last two or three years, or the last 5 years, I suppose, you go to a trade show and everyone is forcing 3D down your throat, like you're starving and they want to feed you. It's kind of weird. It's moved on now from 3D to 4K, which is sort of the spiritual successor to HD, four times the resolution of Blu-ray, for example. And so there are a lot of companies that are starting to show off their 4K televisions. And the ones that we've seen so far have been absolutely massive. Sony, for example, which I saw in person yesterday, it's an 84-inch screen. And it has a resolution so big that when you stand in front of it, despite the fact that it's a massive, massive screen, it's still it's clearer than you would see even watching HD on like a 30-inch panel. It's kind of ludicrous in a way, and that's why it costs, I think, about £20,000 when it comes out later this year.
Wow.
But this is the way that these sort of technologies have always been. You start off with something that's really prohibitively expensive and only gets bought by, people who own oil. and as was the case with 3D and OLED TVs and things like that, but eventually competition heats up, the technologies get cheaper, and you start seeing them creep into people's homes, just like HD did and 3D would have done if it wasn't so lame. So 4K really has been is a big trend this year.
So hang on. So is this a similar shift to how we saw with something like, you know, the iPad and then getting a Retina display? I mean, surely the HD is pretty damn faithful to the actual image.
You would be surprised how unfaithful it is to the image when you consider the amount of pixels that you can physically see, or rather, when you think about the number of pixels you actually need in an area in order to not be able to discern between one or the other. And you know, if you get close enough to HD, you can still make out that, you know, it's not perfect and it's a bit jaggy.
Yeah.
But even on these sort of giant 80-inch screens that we're starting to see this year, you can get close to them and you can't really see the pixels because they're incredibly small and incredibly tight together. Exactly like you say in the iPad. If you look at, say, the iPad 2, which had a resolution of, I think, 1024 by 768, it looks fine really when you first see it. But now when you see the new iPad and you think, you know, this is incredible resolution, when you see the old one you think, wow, that's so old and blurry and awful. And I think that's how I'm going to start feeling now when I come back and look at HD, having seen 4K on some of these TVs. I'm just going to start looking at its flaws, which is a real shame. But it is really cool. But one of the other trends I wanted to point out as well is we're seeing a new type of tablet laptop, which I've been calling a tab top. And these... I know. I've always wanted to coin a phrase. So I'm kind of feeling
that... I think that's a bad one.
Well, we'll see. We'll see if it catches on. Everyone should start using it. But basically what this is if you can imagine a tablet computer, a bit like an iPad, that sort of... You can slide out a keyboard and the screen sort of flips up and the keyboard effectively becomes like a dock. So you're looking at basically like a netbook or an ultrabook. We're seeing loads of those this year because Windows 8 is about to come out and has these two distinct desktop varieties, one that's designed for tablets and one that's designed for desktops. And you know, laptops traditionally don't have a touchscreen, and so the tablet version of the desktop is useless. And similarly, if you use a tablet then that doesn't have a mouse, then the desktop version on a touchscreen isn't generally very good. So companies like Sony, like I think Dell and Toshiba, and I think Toshiba anyway, I haven't actually seen if they have one in person yet, but companies are making these tablets that are basically a tablet with a keyboard that slides out. And they're quite interesting and they look really weird, and I can't decide whether I actually like them or not. But I actually do think that I would use one in certain scenarios, a bit like actually Aoife. I would benefit from not having to carry a MacBook Pro and an iPad around, and just carry one that basically does the job of both. But I think this is a real trend. We're going to start seeing these kind of tablets that morph into little ultrabooks, and they're really powerful. They're full fledged laptops. Some of them. Samsung has one that's a tablet that has a dock, a keyboard dock, which is sort of a little bit similar. And this thing's got like an Intel Core i5 processor and 4 GB of RAM, and you know, it's a really tricked out piece of kit. So that's a new trend.
Awesome. So what was your favorite product so far?
I've had to think about this one, but I have to say I really liked a little tablet that Samsung showed off, which was a little Windows RT tablet that's really, really thin and has a really good, really awesome screen. And it runs the version of Windows that's designed specifically to just really be run on tablets. So not for running things like Photoshop and Steam and your sort of traditional Windows apps. It's kind of like Samsung's Windows flavor alternative to the iPad, if you like, called the, what's it called? The Avit, it's Vita backwards, the Ative Tab, I think it's called. It's going to be out in October when Windows 8 goes on sale. Really cute little tablet. It's not the most groundbreaking piece of tech, but I just found myself liking it. It's just this really nice little tablet. So I did a piece on the site. If you search for, I don't know, Ative Tab, I think you'll find it. ATIV Tab. You'll find my photos and write-up about that.
Great. Well, thank you very much. We'll let you get back to the tech fest that is Aoife, and we'll see you when you're back.
Yes, you certainly shall. Cheers, Liv.
Thanks very much, Nate. Now, that's pretty much all we have time for. So, Ian, why don't you tell us how people can get in touch with us?
Sure thing. You can email us at podcast@wired.co.uk. We're on Twitter, @wiredUK. Facebook page, which is brilliant and awesome, and you should definitely click like on that. And you can also call us on Skype for free around the world on we're Wired UK Podcast.
And please do leave a message. Tell us what you had for lunch, maybe.
Yeah, dinner, lunch, breakfast, you know, all the things.
Actually, don't do that. Tell us something much more exciting. Well, with that, I'd like to say goodbye. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
I think you should brush up on your astrophysics. No, I have no idea. I'm just picturing this crazy orbiting structure.